May it please the court, counsel. My name is Pam Dayton, registration number 19735, and I represent the defendant, Javon Davis. This is a sexual assault case that was a difficult case for the prosecutor. There were no witnesses. There was inconclusive physical evidence, that is, physical evidence consistent with either consensual or non-consensual sex. And the case, therefore, hinged entirely on the credibility of the victim. The prosecution's problems included the circumstances, the relationship between the two parties, and the circumstances of that evening. The victim went to Mr. Davis's house at 3 a.m. in response to what Mr. Davis has called a booty call. The defendant and the victim have known each other for 2 years, and they had a prior sexual relationship. The victim's initial statements to the police when she reported this as a sexual assault were problematic as well. First, she spoke to two friends right after she left Mr. Davis's house, and she didn't tell either one of them that she'd been sexually assaulted. When she talked to the police, she told them that she knew Mr. Davis only as, quote, JD, and that he was someone who, quote, hung around her job. She said she'd never been to his apartment before, and when she took police to the apartment, she pointed out the wrong one. She didn't tell the police that she and Mr. Davis had had a prior sexual relationship, and she left out parts of the sexual encounter that evening that also were problematic. She left out the part where she received oral sex from Mr. Davis. She later acknowledged both that she'd been to the apartment before and that their sexual encounter had included oral sex. The prosecutor's strategy for dealing with these problems at trial was twofold. He had to deal with all of this in closing argument, and what he decided to do was to explain away the inconsistencies in the victim's statements and the story and the sort of half-truths that she told initially as typical of rape victims, a quote, normal or expected response to this kind of traumatic event. In addition to that, he attempted to dissuade jurors from critically looking at the evidence. He told them the trial is not a search for doubt, it's a search for truth, and told them that it was their job not to challenge the evidence, and also told them to remember, to keep in mind that she, the victim, was not on trial. Both of these strategies were completely improper in the way that the prosecutor did this. And I'll begin with the attempt to place the victim's inconsistencies in this in a framework that explains it away as typical of the response of a rape victim. What the prosecutor did was he broadcast on a 6x6 screen a PowerPoint presentation, which all of you have as an appendix in the back of the opening brief. And he set out what he called the three stages of victim's response to a traumatic event. He called one the first stage the initial stage, then he identified a secondary stage and a final stage. And for each of those stages, he identified some characteristics or some emotional states of or mental states that would accompany those stages of adjustment to a trauma. And then he, on the other side, listed the pieces of evidence that were problematic. So either her statements or her actions or her demeanor, and then argue to the jury that these particular aspects of her behavior and statements and demeanor were consistent with these the expected stages that he had previously identified.
Excuse me, Ms.
Yes.
Just ask you this. The prosecutor couched his statements about the stages in terms of common sense and common experience. Can you speak to that, please?
Certainly. He prefaced his comments with that kind of remark. He said, you know, reason and common sense and experience tells us that there are stages to coping with a trauma. And then he proceeded to identify these stages. The problem with that is reason and common sense are not the things that lead us to understand that there are stages that a victim may go through in emotional adjustment. I mean, this understanding is a product of social science, and it is the product of a number of years of research that were that endeavored to counteract the problem that prosecutors were having because rape victims' response did not comport with what the ordinary layperson would expect. And I cited this in my brief, the language, and I think it was Hamden that explained, you know, it's precisely because rape victims generally don't or often don't respond the way that the average person would expect that this science developed.
Is there any reason to believe at this point that that social science has entered into common knowledge and common experience for the average juror?
You know, I think that's a hard question, but I don't think so. I think that there may be there's probably some general sense. People have heard the term post-traumatic stress disorder. They've heard the terms, you know, rape trauma syndrome. Whether or not people have any sense of what the particulars are and what that really entails, I don't think that's common enough for it to be considered within the average layperson's understanding. And our cases bear this out. I mean, every one of our cases that deals with rape trauma syndrome has identified it as the proper subject of expert testimony. If this were something, a subject that was within the grasp of the average citizen, considered to be within everyone's common knowledge, this would not be the subject of expert testimony.
Ms. Dayton, am I correct, therefore, in assuming that the prosecution could have presented an expert on rape trauma syndrome in this case?
I think so, sure. I think the prosecutor, our cases indicate that rape trauma syndrome evidence is admissible generally, so long as it's done properly, and so long as it's not used improperly, it's admissible. The problem with what the prosecutor did in this case is, well, there are a couple of problems with what he did, but he didn't. There was no evidence presented on this issue, and no expert testimony, no lay testimony, and he took rape trauma syndrome and then morphed it into or adapted it in a way that suited his particular purpose at trial, which was to bolster the victim's credibility. He did not present, and I tried to describe this in my opening brief, you know, how rape trauma syndrome has been described and defined by the relevant authorities. And you can see when you compare the two that what the prosecutor did was he took certain things and sort of cherry-picked bits of, this characteristic or that characteristic in order to use the ones that fit his purposes and then left the rest behind because they didn't suit his purposes. I mean, and if you look at it as a whole, you can see that if he had had an expert on rape trauma syndrome at trial, it might not have gone his way.
Counsel, excuse me.
Yeah.
But I am not fully familiar with the entire record. I haven't looked at it all yet. But I did see that a week before trial, there was an endorsement of an expert witness on rape trauma syndrome. Is there anything in the record that would indicate why that expert did not testify?
No. You know, I don't recall anything. So, it could be, frankly, that the prosecutor was thinking about presenting that testimony, and either the witness wasn't available, he didn't arrange it soon enough, or that the witness just wasn't going to be able to say what he needed the witness to say. I mean, there are a number of reasons why that could be the case. So
I know that you probably want to reserve the rest of your time. At some point during either now or when you come back for rebuttal, assuming you do, I'd hope that you would address why, if we agree with you that this was error, that it's not harmless.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll do that on rebuttal if that's okay.
And why it should be considered to be constitutional error.
Okay. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. And before I get to the first issue, I do want to comment briefly on the fourth issue, which is the extraordinary risk sentencing. And as I'm sure you already know, Tillery, People versus Tillery, essentially solves this issue and resolves it against us. Extraordinary risk sentencing would not apply, except for the fact if there were aggravating circumstances present, which Tillery also addresses, and in that, which case the sentence would be proper. I wanted to bring that to this court's attention since neither my brief nor either of the opening reply brief managed to find Tillery. So my apologies for that. Unless you have any questions about the second issue, the due process issue, I'll go ahead and leap right into the issue of prosecutorial misconduct. There are several reasons why there was no misconduct that warranted reversal, and I'll start off with that this just wasn't rape trauma syndrome under discussion. Secondarily, the focus was not on, even if it was rape trauma syndrome, it wasn't on the syndrome itself, it was on the victim's demeanor. And thirdly, the victim's credibility was one of, if not the key issue contested by the defendant throughout trial, saying that she was incredible and that the sex was consensual. And that's what the entirety of the prosecution's closing argument went to. Before I went there, I heard from both of you that there was some interest in the harmless error versus constitutional harmless error. And I'll go ahead and start with that, just to make sure I get a few words about that in. This is a harmless error analysis. It has nothing to do with constitutional harmless error. And here's why. People versus Kreider is the controlling case in this matter. And People versus Kreider talks about ethical boundaries, which is something along the lines of threatening to mislead the jury with personal opinion or bias or subject to inflaming their passions. It's talking, it specifically addresses defendants' constitutional rights as something that would invoke constitutional harmless error. We're talking about a jury, the right to a jury trial, the right to testify, the right to post-arrest silence. Here, what we have is, if this court believes there's error, and we're not conceding there was error, but for the purposes of this argument, if there was error, then it was error only in commenting on facts that would not be in evidence, because you would be assuming that rape trauma syndrome was what the prosecution was addressing, and that would be facts not in evidence.
There'd be a confrontation problem if, in effect, this was expert testimony, if we were to conclude this was expert testimony that the prosecutor was trying to put in?
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Because there's no opportunity to cross-examine.
But it's well established that at this point, we're not talking about, at this point, rape trauma syndrome is admissible. That's per Hampton and Farley, and I believe it's Walters. So it's not, we're not confronting the basic correctness of rape trauma syndrome. We're not confronting the accuracy of the syndrome as a scientific principle. What we're confronting is whether or not it would have been admissible. And here, it's clear that it would have been admissible because we have several opinions that have already addressed that issue. So consequently, what we're talking about is evidence that wasn't put in, and that's an ethical boundary. And that's what Kreider specifically says, that we stop with ethical boundaries for basic harmless error analysis.
Michaels, let me stop you there and ask you then, are the people conceding that there was no evidence in the record that would have supported the argument that was made by the prosecutor?
If I understand your question correctly, we would be conceding that there was no expert testimony on rape trauma syndrome. at least as far as I can tell. However, there was testimony about the victim's demeanor, and that's what the prosecution's comment, the prosecution's closing arguments focused on.
Let me ask you a couple questions about that then. I'd like to focus on the same question that I asked your colleague, and that is, I noticed that the prosecutor couched this in terms of common sense and common experience.
Absolutely.
And I guess I'm wondering how that could be, how any juror could have any common sense or common experience about such a situation.
I think actually the case People versus Walters is a good contrast to this. And in People versus Walters, to refresh your memory, we had a prosecutor who talked about the defendant having multiple sclerosis, MS, and he talked about how everyone knows what multiple sclerosis is. My boss has it. Your boss has it. It doesn't deal with, I believe it was a lack of sexual appetite, essentially. The problem with Walters was that it used a lot of very scientific terms, multiple sclerosis, its symptoms, its results, and it talked about specifically his boss, which was not in evidence and hadn't been discussed. Here we're talking about, is he's talking about common experiences. What happens when you are attacked? What happens if you are the victim of an assault? And he wasn't saying specifically sexual assault. He's saying, what experiences do we expect a victim to respond with?
That's how I'm, what I'm struggling with. I'm wondering how an average juror would have any knowledge of what how someone would react in those circumstances.
However, just from common experiences, everyone is aware of...
Not everyone knows a rape victim, that's for certain.
But we're not talking necessarily about rape victims. We're talking, and the prosecutor started off by saying, not necessarily rape victims, he's saying trauma victims. He's saying somebody who's been attacked, someone who has had an immediate, tangible, visceral challenge in their life where they've been hurt. And that's something that... What his point was is, well, what do we expect out of that? How does somebody react to that? The point is, we don't know how people react to it. People move through that in stages, and those stages might be different for different people, and this is what this particular victim's stages went through. She got out, she went to the car, she didn't know what had happened to her. She knew what he had wanted. He had wanted a booty call, as he admitted readily. But she didn't know how that had affected her. She couldn't process that. And it wasn't until she got home that she started realizing and moving into a different acceptance that I've been assaulted, I've been hurt, I've had this man force his penis into my mouth, I've had him force it into my vagina, I've had him force it into my anus. And none of that was anything that she had gone over there or understood what happened to her.
But how, even if average jurors have known somebody that had trauma, what experience would they have that would tell them there are three stages and what they would expect to see at each stage?
I don't think he was talking specifically about these are all the stages that a victim is going to go through. He's talking about this is the first, this was her first period of reaction. Her initial stage, her first stage was, oh God, what's happened to me? I don't understand. Her second one was she got angry, she was afraid. And her third one was, okay, it's time to do something about it, it's time to move on.
Mr. Michaels, the impression I got from reading the briefs was that the prosecutor was trying to generalize his statements about these three stages so that they were statements that were generally applicable, and then the prosecutor tried to apply them to this case. Would you agree with that?
I would agree that he was making the statements general because general statements are what is going to fall into people's common experience. What? How do you first react when you're a victim of a trauma? Are you shocked? Are you angry? What do you want to do? Well, this victim couldn't process it. And I think in terms of looking at it as quote-unquote rape trauma syndrome, which again wasn't mentioned at trial, People versus Hampton doesn't talk about a three-stage rape trauma syndrome. People versus Hampton talks about a two-stage rape trauma syndrome. And what it lists is not any of these initial stages that the prosecution listed and discussed in this closing argument. What People versus Hampton talks about is a fear of violence, a fear of death, a fear of humiliation, embarrassment, anger, and revenge. And that's stage one. Well, we don't have that in the stage one, quote-unquote stage one of this prosecution, of this prosecutor's closing argument. And then in stage two, People versus Hampton the Red Trauma Syndrome in People versus Hampton is completely different than any of the stages that the prosecutor here talks about. Disorganization in lifestyle, change in home, nightmares, sleep disturbances. We don't see any of that here. We don't see any of that discussion in the rape trauma syndrome, quote-unquote, stages that are put forth to the in the closing argument. What we have is a prosecutor saying, this is what the victim experienced. The defendant is going to attack her credibility. He's going to say these are inconsistent with consensual sex. I'm telling you that they are consistent with her reactions. This is how she reacted. The fact that they're inconsistent with what the defendant is going to tell you is consensual sex doesn't mean that that's not so. What it means is this victim was assaulted, and this is how she went through it.
Counsel, I'm looking at the PowerPoints, and you know it starts out saying expectations. On the left, it has these three stages. On the right, it talks about the victim and her specific behavior. And obviously, it's trying to fit her specific behavior in, when he's discussing it, into those three stages. And we have no evidence in the record to know where these three, where he came up with these three stages, the first stage, shock, disbelief, and confusion. Is there anything in the record that would indicate that that's some initial stage?
There's nothing in the record to indicate that that's an initial stage so much as that was her initial response, and that's what she first went through with that shock, with that anger. He's not necessarily talking about this protracted set of stages. He's talking about 24 hours and how she would progress through those 24 hours.
Oh, and the question I asked of Ms. Dayton, do you know why the expert on rape trauma syndrome did not testify? Is that in the record?
I do not, and to be perfectly frank about it, I didn't even notice that the expert was endorsed as a rape trauma syndrome expert. So your guess at this point is as good as mine, but that's part of the problem is that this entire thing is speculative, whether the prosecution was going off and, as opposing counsel says, cherry-picking these little nuggets out of rape trauma syndrome. It's speculative. We don't know that he was sitting at home at a computer pulling off rape trauma syndrome off of Wikipedia, which is itself unreliable. What we know is what he put forward to the jury and the evidence he put forward, and that was this defendant, this victim testified very strongly, I didn't go over there for consensual sex. I went over there because I thought there was an emergency. I went over there because I thought there was an emergency with his kids. I'd made clear to him several times before that I wasn't going to have sex with him again. And when I got there, he first attacked me, and then he attacked me some more, and then he finally let me go. And here's the thing. The jury clearly believed that the victim was raped. It doesn't, even if we put this, even if we assume that this was a rape trauma syndrome closing argument, and that he improperly commented on evidence that wasn't in the record, it's still harmless error. Because they acquitted him of the anal sexual assault, because the victim herself testified that she thought it was accidental. While she said it was accidental because it just happened while we were struggling. The defendant himself said we didn't have anal intercourse, so then how do you explain the DNA that's in her rectum? The physical evidence placed the defendant's DNA in the rectum, so there's no doubt that that happened. It's just a question of how. Well, the defendant said it didn't happen. So in order to believe that the defendant's DNA got there, but without the defendant's intention, it had to have happened while she was struggling, while he was holding her down. So any evidence is harmless. And we see that because the jury said, you know what? We don't think he knowingly sexually assaulted her. Never mind the fact that the DNA says, places his DNA was placed in her rectum. Once the jury determined she was struggling, then the sexual assault is proved, regardless of the prosecution's statement about rape trauma syndrome. The victim herself testified about the different stages and the different experiences that she had as she went through it. And this is, she has a very long testimony, as I'm sure you've well reviewed. It talks about how she was in shock first, upset, fear. She didn't know what to do. Then she went back home and she just wanted to curl up in that fetal position. She was afraid. She didn't know how to respond. She was hurt. Her friends came. They helped her process it. And they all testified as to her, the stages that they saw her go through. And there's quite a bit of testimony from her friends saying, this is what we saw, this is how she progressed. So we are talking about stages, just not in the sense of expert testimony. the fact that she didn't want to identify the defendant immediately isn't necessarily inconsistent with the fact that she's been raped. In fact, that is perhaps possibly more consistent. We don't know. It was an acquaintance of hers, somebody that she knew from work, somebody she knew had known for a long time. So it's not something necessarily that she's really ready or willing to do. She doesn't know how to proceed. There's no book for rape victims. I'm almost out of time, and I just wanted to touch very briefly on the double jeopardy issue, unless there's any more questions about this. There is no double jeopardy problem. The question is whether the legislature intended to authorize multiple punishments. There's no question it did. 18.3402 says sex assault is inflicting sexual penetration on a victim. The definition of sexual penetration is intercourse, cunnilingus, fellatio, anal intercourse. Any penetration, however slight, is sufficient to complete the crime. They are separately charged. There are separate facts for each of them. The jury convicted on 2 of 3, which is even more compelling. And there are concurrent sentences, which is what the legislature's way of authorizing multiple convictions, but not excessive punishment. I see my time's up, so unless there are further questions, we ask you to affirm in all respects. Thank you.
I think if the prosecutor had made the argument that Mr. Michaels made, it might have been an okay argument. That is, if he had said, you know, we all know someone who's been through a traumatic situation, and we know from that the experience is one that lasts over a period of time, and we go through different stages, you know, in that, without using the medical or scientific terminology that this prosecutor did, such as shock and trauma, dissociation. These are terms of art. So it's not the kind of colloquial argument that Mr. Michaels was sort of making it out to be. This is clearly an argument that suggests medical scientific basis, and our cases have all recognized this. So I don't want to belabor the point unless there are more questions about it. Mr. Michaels also made the point that the literature discusses, or that Hamden discusses, rape trauma syndrome as a two-stage syndrome. I would just point out that if you look at the literature, and I've looked at a lot of it, and a number of law review articles that deal with it, it's variously described in two stages or three stages. They all really deal with the same thing. It just depends on the author and who's describing. So I don't think that's really significant. And you can look at the set of characteristics that have been described in the literature, and then you can look at what the prosecutor did in this case, and you can see that he chose two or three specific things that helped him deal with the inconsistencies and the problems in the victim's testimony, and then left the rest. And you can see from what's left of the rest, and this is described to some extent in my brief, that there's probably a good reason why he left the rest, because her testimony and her conduct doesn't really fit. So this is the prosecutor getting the best of all worlds, basically, getting to testify in closing argument scientific evidence that supports his theory without having to deal with the parts of it that don't, without the expert or being subjected to cross-examination to point out what's not consistent with that or what doesn't fit, all of which would probably have hurt the end result for him. Regarding whether or not this could be conceived as harmless, I say absolutely not. I mean, this case entirely depended on this victim's credibility and the jury's assessment of that credibility. Even given the way the prosecutor argued this case, this was no easy task for the jury. They deliberated for 2 days. This wasn't a, you know, a two-hour verdict where it was easy. This was a difficult case, and I think that anyone would be hard-pressed to suggest that this argument did not contribute to the verdict in this case. The combined effect of, you know, explaining away the problems with the victim's testimony and then, you know, urging the jurors not to look too closely at it and to keep in mind that she's the victim, she's not on trial. The combined effect of that certainly contributed to the verdict in this case. Regarding whether or not this is constitutional error, I argue in my reply brief, especially I focus on that, and I would say yes. I mean, this is the kind of error that I think even Kreider, which arguably narrowed the range of constitutional error. I think even under Kreider, this is constitutional error. I mean, this error certainly impacted Mr. Davis's confrontation rights. It certainly impacted the fairness of his trial, and it was certainly a due process violation. So for all of those reasons, I addressed them in my reply brief. I know my time is up here, but I would ask that you reverse this case.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. We really appreciate them and the briefing. And the case will now stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.